Great to have you along on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're covering legal issues for the next hour and a half or so with our two guests, Mike Riley and Tom Colpin. Mike is a retired Madison attorney. His practice focused on obtaining fair compensation for people who suffer injuries due to others' negligence, and he is what they call an off-counsel attorney at Axley Law Firm. Mike, welcome back. Good to have you with
us. Thanks, Larry. It's always a pleasure.
And Tom Colpin, an attorney who practices family law, paternity, estates, planning, and I guess a whole lot more. A partner in the Axley Law Firm, he recently served as Rock County Family Court Commissioner, doing that for nearly 8 years. Tom, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
And just a reminder today, our discussion is intended as general information. You should not be relied on or construed as legal advice. I wanted to get that out just to begin the show. Family law deals with so many issues. Give us your questions about divorce or guardianship. We can take your questions personal injury as well as we move along today. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And Tom, just before we get going, I sort of mentioned you as a broad range of things. Where's all your experience lie, really?
Sure. Family law encompasses quite a few different types of legal issues. Like you mentioned, for nearly 8 years, I was the Rock County Family Court Commissioner, where I presided over divorces, post-divorce issues. So folks that have finalized their divorce, new issues have come up of dispute. You can separate them into custody, placement, child support, determinations of paternity, maintenance, property division. Anything you can possibly think of that a family might have conflict in is something I used to do as a family court commissioner. Now I'm in private practice. And really, the trend is shifting with many of our practitioners to try to get people to help resolve their conflicts before they make it to the court. So I'm focusing a lot on mediation, out-of-court settlement type negotiations, mediation, arbitration. Parent coordinators are a new thing for those high-conflict cases that tend to find themselves into court all of the time. There's some delay with the court system and getting your conflict scheduled to have a decision. So we're really pushing people into making solutions instead of hoping for long-term decisions with the court.
Makes a lot of sense to me. And Mike, I know you wanted to talk a bit about risk and risk issues today on the show, among other things.
Yeah, I thought this was triggered by a call I got from some very nice folks who had just bought some land from their mother. They had two families, two of the siblings were buying the land and they were splitting it. And they had concerns about what their liability might be if for activities on the land. And in the course of the discussion, we talked a lot about insurance, of course, and they had consulted with their insurance company, really with their agent, and they had talked to him about they had an umbrella. And the question was whether that would cover activities on the land. And frankly, I would have thought it would not. The agent had told them it would. And I said, that's great, but I'd get it in writing because, you know, you want to be certain that if you're relying on that, that you have that protection. But it just brought up a lot of issues about risk. For one thing, the company they'd been with for 30 years. And I think for so many of us, we go with an insurance company and we just stay there. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. In this particular case, they're with a national company that used to have a really good reputation, at least among attorneys, both plaintiff and defense, and really has pretty much squandered that. They're not held in high regard by anyone within the legal profession. And frankly, they're probably not a company I'd want to be insured with. And I suggested, as we've talked about before, look around, shop around. Every time you see an ad for an insurance company, they talk about how much money you can save. Well, that's because, you know, if you go to a different company, the reason you switch usually is money. You know, it's because you're getting a better deal. And that's important. But just as important is having a company you can rely on, because people think that life is full of more risk than it is. The fact is, most of us never have a serious motor vehicle accident. most of us, thank heaven, don't have a house burned down. Mm-hmm. But if any of those things happen, even though they're unlikely, you better have a company that's going to take care of you and protect you. And so that's really important. We talked a lot about land ownership. There's a statute called the Recreational Immunity Statute, which is really pretty broad. And it was initially lobbied for and sold as the Hunters and Berry Pickers, Deer Hunters and Berry Pickers Law. And it's a lot broader than that. So if you own recreational property and you simply permit people to go on the property, you have virtually no liability at all. I mean, you have very broad protection against liability. On the other hand, which I've always found ironic, if you invite people on your land, if you have a party, and I had a case just like that where people had a party, they had a hill, they had lights on their little sledding hill, and they had, unfortunately, those were on telephone poles, which they didn't shield, and somebody was injured badly. A social guest is an exception to the recreational immunity statute. So, you know, an actual host, suddenly you assume liability you wouldn't have otherwise had. But I just think, in general, risk is an interesting issue, because that's what insurance is all about, is risk spreading. You know, you pay a certain amount based on what you might have to lose, and, you know, you gauge your needs for insurance, again, on what you have to lose. If you're 22 years old and just out of college, you probably don't need a lot of liability insurance. If you're, you know, in your 40s, 50s, or for that matter, in your 30s these days, you know, if you're a tech wizard and you've got a lot to lose, then you better have a lot more insurance coverage. Anyway, those are just some thoughts on that.
There's things to bring up, or maybe that might spur some other questions. And speaking of questions, all our lines are filled. So Brad in Janesville. We'll go to Brad in Janesville first. Brad, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call. This is about parking and zoning. Hopefully one of your guys is knowledgeable. There's a small village in Rock County, and in this village there's a small commercial street. There's no residences on it. So it's only business. And a couple of years ago, they instituted a very strict no parking regulation on that street, $500 fine, put up signs everywhere. I've gotten two tickets, and I've paid a lesser fine amount, but my friends and other commercial contractors get ticketed on this street all the time. And to make matters, you know, even look a little bit more shady, they're allowing one business owner on this street to just simply take photos of quote-unquote violations and then submit them to the court. The court issues tickets, and then they call in this business owner to testify that, yes, Your Honor, I saw him and he was parked there.
So you're wondering about challenging this this issue of having this street blocked off. I'm taking it, Brad.
Since Tom's from
Rock County in the state.
Yeah. Well, you're in Rock County, Tom.
Sure. Hi, Brad from Janesville. I'm Tom from Janesville. I work in the Janesville office for Axley Attorneys. So really what I'm hearing is maybe two separate issues. Number one is, how do you challenge the municipal citation and whether you should be imposed a forfeiture for violation? And you have your court process to handle that, where you receive your court date. You can challenge the case and whether you should be imposed a forfeiture to a judge. And I'm sure either you or your friends have gone through that process, and perhaps you've even negotiated your lower forfeiture with the local city attorney, assistant city attorney. I think his name's Nels Chomey. And if that's the case, I think that's a great result if you can do that. Number two is really whether or not there's an ability to challenge how that street has the no parking sign, the specific forfeiture. I will not profess to have this be part of my expertise, but what I would say is, you mentioned that this is a village. I would make sure that your village board knows exactly what the community's complaints are with that, and ask them to address your complaints in that regard, and see if there's a way that you can somehow change the landscape of that parking ordinance itself. And I think if it's a village, you've got to start with the village. And if it's in the city limits, you start with the city. That's where I kind of see two different issues. Number one, with the municipal court side of things, if there's a witness who can come to court and testify that they have personally observed a violation of an ordinance, and that's the fundamental part of our legal process, is you have the right to confront in court witnesses who testify against you. You have the right to present any independent evidence. And if that person who owns that business says, look, there's an ordinance here that says you can't park here, people are commonly doing it, we want to address that on our end because we feel we're affected by it. So we're going to take pictures. We're going to share it with the local municipal law enforcement agency or the city attorney or village attorney. And we want those tickets issued. If they're following the ordinance, unfortunately, I think you got a difficult leg to stand on the municipal court side of things. So my advice would be that you got to get to that village board or the city, the local governing agency, and voice your complaints loudly there. Perhaps I'm saying something you've already tried, but that's the best I can offer you to right now.
Yeah,
that's great advice, Tom. And I think in general, you know, when people get tickets, some people just choose to pay, and that's obviously your choice. You can almost always negotiate tickets down. If it's a county, then you go, deal with the district attorney. If it's, a city, a municipality, it's either a city attorney or a village attorney. And it's something you should do because it's almost automatic that they will reduce the fine. Tom?
Yeah, something to add to that. That's a great point, Mike. I would encourage the people who are receiving these ordinances, if you take issue with the parking itself, first of all, you're not going to get the judge or perhaps the village or city attorney to change the ordinance because you've challenged it. But if enough people challenge it, you highlight a problem. A really quick example of that, many years ago, I was a municipal attorney for a village in outside of Beloit and Janesville. And this was back when it was illegal to get paid out to gamble on those gambling machines at the local restaurants and bars. And a local bar would consistently send over complaints for people writing checks that would bounce. We call them worthless checks. And if the worthless check amount was didn't reach a certain threshold as far as monetary value, the local agency, the police department, would issue tickets for worthless checks. And enough people started saying, wait a second, I'm getting prosecuted for worthless checks when I was writing checks to the bar for purposes of illegal gambling. And as the municipal attorney in that situation, I kept seeing, now our municipal court's getting bogged down by all of these challenges, and I've got to justify to the court why this person should pay a fine. So then I went to the village board, and I said, we've got a problem here. You need to go talk to this local business owner and say, you can't publicly violate the law and expect that we enforce the same law that affects you negatively, right? So the lesson here is don't hesitate to exercise your rights to challenge these ordinances because the winds of change can move in different directions, even though one individual case may not necessarily change that ordinance.
The other thing you might think about, and we won't beat it to death, but talking to the Janesville Gazette or the local paper, somebody there might be interested. Finally, dealing with these villages can really be a problem. We had a client years ago who had a piece of land that was landlocked. Well, you couldn't do it. And we went to the village board and I said, you have to give them access. No, we weren't going to do it. And ultimately we went to court. They had to pay our costs. They lost. I told them they wouldn't listen. And after the whole thing, I talked to the president of the board and I said, well, why would you do this? And he said, well, my nephew owned the other land that you're getting the access over. So I think Tom had suggested that already. But you wonder if the business owner who's taking photos, what his relationship
sure.
is. Anyway, enough.
Mike Riley and Tom Klopian, our guests today with the Axley Law Firm of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. We're taking your questions, dealing a little with family law. We've dealing with a variety of things, actually, with our two guests from Axley Law Firm, Michael Riley and Tom Klopian. And you can join in, 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. Lolita in Madison, we'll go to you. Thank you for waiting. Hi.
Hi. I'm calling because I established a trust about 20 years ago when my husband passed away. Uh-huh. And I'm in my 70s now. And I'd like to make some minor changes, like changing the executor and making some changes for my DCHPOA, things like that.
Sure.
Can I just do an amendment and have it notarized? Because I call the lawyers and they charge a lot, like $350 an hour, and they're just minor changes.
Yeah.
Thanks, Lolita.
Go ahead.
Here's a difficult way to answer this. Without seeing what your trust says and how intricate and detailed it is, it's extremely difficult to adequately tell you whether you should simply write something up and have it notarized. I'm sure that you may feel like, well, this is how the lawyers get you. They want to charge you that high rate. But what you could think is an easy solution could create a massive problem if you're not exactly sure what your trust says and how you want to change it. Essentially, making minor changes like who you want to be the personal representative of your estate upon your passing, which I think you used the term executor, they're interchangeable terms, oftentimes used in Wisconsin as the term personal representative. If you want to make that change, it would seem rather simple for you to be able to do that, where you don't need to rewrite your entire trust. And similarly, if you're making changes to your healthcare power of attorney, where you want to rename some new agents, it wouldn't seem to be too difficult to be able to do that. However, depending on the kind of trust you have, the laws have changed significantly in the last 20 years in ways in which people have maximized the purpose of trusts. I would advise you to contact a lawyer or a law firm and ask if they conduct free consultations. This should be something rather simple for someone who works in this area on a regular basis, who wouldn't charge, to be able to review your document and give you that kind of urgent care diagnosis of here's what I think you might need. But I definitely wouldn't advise you to simply write something up and go to someone who notarizes your signature. The general public assumes that when you get something notarized, that it has some sort of important legal effect. And all a notary does is it personally swears that they have identified you as the person who signed the document. It doesn't make that document any better. It doesn't make it any more enforceable. It only acknowledges that we have made sure that Lolita is the person who signed that on that day.
Mm-hmm. There you go, Lolita. Thank you for calling. Paul and Toma, we'll go to you next. Hi, Paul.
Thank you. This call is probably similar to Lolita's. I am going to be 67 this year. I really don't have family, kids. I'm not married. Brothers, older nephews, in good shape financially. If I leave stuff to them, they'll just go buy cars. And that's my father used to sell insurance. And that's what he said. People just buy cars when you die. I would like to find somebody, an executor of some sort, whether it be a law firm, a bank, that would perhaps I could set up a trust. All of my assets, which should total to about $1 million, that would then be distributed over perhaps 10 or 20 years through my Roth, through different charitable investments. The government puts out a book that lists all of the reputable charitable investments that you can put your money into and lists their overhead fees and things like that. So perhaps an executor who would just go through and every year pick 10, give money to those funds, the next year pick another 10. But somebody who would do that until the trust was either fully liquidated or into perpetuity, because, again, my Roth is before the change of those laws, and just keep it going. Is there somebody I can go to that can actually set up such of an account that would follow my directives but wouldn't have the ability to filter off too much into their own pocket? I understand their expenses, but otherwise it's just going to get squandered. And
Yeah. Okay. Paul or Tom, I guess we'll go to you for
sure.
That one.
Sure. I think one of the biggest takeaways I have from your example is you don't want your brother and you don't want your nephews to have exclusive control over how that money is spent. because you would like to see it directed in other ways. And you want to do it through the form of a trust. You can certainly do that. I would strongly advise that you retain an attorney to draft the trust. And that trust can name a corporate trustee. Oftentimes, if you work with a highly experienced and sophisticated law firms and lawyers in your community, they do this all of the time. And they probably have a good list of banks with trust departments or investment firms with trust departments that could easily take over control and management. I couldn't tell you what they would charge for fees. I think that that would be something you'd want to look into. But I definitely think this is something you could easily do through the form of a trust, and you would be able to dictate how it is spent over time based upon the amount that you have. And most good, experienced estate planning lawyers that work in the area of drafting trusts, they have many different templates and examples because they've trusted them and they've worked over time to minimize risk of conflict in the future, but also to give you some examples of how you might want to allocate exactly where that goes over the course of time and how it's preserved for the future.
Yeah. Mike, how do you pick a good, now Paul's in Toma, how do you pick a good attorney for something like that?
Well, it's, you know, part of it always is personal contacts. If you know people who've used attorneys, you can talk to them, get recommendations. You know, there, Martindale Hubbell ranks attorneys and tells you there's an A, B, C, different things, and a V, which just means they're supposedly very reliable. Nothing is perfect. There's an annual ranking of attorneys that Milwaukee Magazine does called Super Lawyers. And they rank lawyers and give you the names of people who other lawyers think are very good in their field. And that's certainly something that's worth looking at, too. And I think, and Tom can weigh in on this, too, but I think one of the things that we've talked about in the past is go and meet with people. You know, meet with them, talk with them, find out how much they're going to charge you, find out, you know, are you comfortable with them? Because ultimately, when you go to a lawyer, and once you hire them, you're really relying on them. That's why you're there. It's not your field. It's their field. And you really need to have a comfort level because you don't want to be second-guessing yourself or worried about, did I choose the right person? Tom?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think one of the best things you have going for you is the freedom of choice. You know, I would use this analogy quite frequently when I was a family court commissioner and folks would decide to represent themselves and have quite a bit of family conflict and really walk into a courtroom, and understandably so, but have no idea how the law impacts their dispute. The beauty of estate planning is you have freedom of choice. If we want to fly somewhere, we have a couple of airlines, and the prices are usually astronomical, or you get the most affordable but least of experience. And many other aspects of where you hire the professional to do something, you're kind of limited in your choice. And I would argue that within our state and the legal system in general, the choice of law firms with estate planning services is vast, and ordinarily speaking, highly experienced in those areas. And the fee schedules may range, and they usually range based upon area. What you could get from a lawyer for the same level of service in Toma would probably be a different charge than right downtown in the Capitol Square or downtown in Milwaukee. So my advice to you would be to shop around in that circumstance. And like Mike said, meet people. Technology has changed quite a bit. So even if you want to use that bigger office with many attorneys and highly experienced attorneys who handle these types of things in major metropolitan areas, you can do so with technology these days with self-authenticating affidavits, virtual affidavits. So you might not even have to leave Toma if you don't want to. But I would advise you to shop around.
Paul, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Sue in Cable will go to you now. Hi, Sue.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Related question. What is the difference between a POA for finances and a successor trustee?
Power of attorney for finances versus a successor trustee. Tom?
It depends on the trust, but ordinarily speaking, they could be extremely similar. Power of attorney for finances is someone that you designate during your lifetime to stand in your legal shoes, as I usually explain it to people, that they have the same legal authority as you to conduct your business affairs, and they hold what's called a fiduciary duty to do so, which means that they can never make a decision that would ever benefit anyone but you, even if it's to their own personal detriment. So that's a power of attorney during your life. A power of attorney terminates upon your death. However, you could have a trustee overseeing and administering a trust during your lifetime that has very similar powers and duties as a power of attorney during your life. But then a successor trustee could also be someone who has the same authority over the trust to administrate it according to the terms of the trust upon your death. Secondarily, successor simply means they weren't the first. So if you name a trustee in a trust and that person declines to serve as your trustee or is unavailable to serve or you need to name a second one, successor simply means you have nominated them to take over in the event that the first one is unable or unwilling to act.
Sue, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. And let's move on, take another call. Gary in Milwaukee. Hi, Gary.
Well, I have a question. My father recently passed, and he left me a home worth about $60,000. I would like to give this to my daughter. And I'm wondering if there's a limit on how much I can give her on an annual basis. Can I just, we plan to sell the home, can I just sell the home and give her the 360, or do I have to break this into increments that will not, you know, have a tax consequence?
Thanks, Gary. First, I'm sorry to hear about your father's passing, and this is, your question comes up almost every day with estate planning attorneys. I want to be clear that I'll dabble in this. I don't use it as my expertise. I've spent most of my career in the area of family law, and I've oftentimes told people the very second that I don't feel comfortable diving into this, I refer you to an estate planning attorney who do this every day. And I equate it to, I'm a survivor of brain surgery when I was younger, and I never wanted a foot doctor to do my brain surgery, okay?
Yeah.
So I certainly advise that you contact an estate planning attorney. But generally speaking, what you're bringing up is what could trigger the gift tax. And there's an annual allowance that you don't have to report to the federal government of how much you've given away each year to someone. But then there's a lifetime maximum allowance. So even if you don't give away, I believe it's around $18,000, right now, don't quote me on that. Estate planning attorneys who are listening are saying, geez, this guy, come on. but it's around $18,000. And if it's under that, you don't have to report that particular year. But in addition to that, there's a lifetime allowance of if you've gifted so much over the course of your life, that can impact things. So what I would advise you to do is contact hopefully, if your father drafted a will and that attorney or the law firm is still around, start there because they probably have notes and information about how they drafted your dad's will and created that estate plan. But make sure that you do that in a way where, I mean, there could be ways for you to disclaim receipt of the home within the estate process that then passes to your daughter with no tax consequence at all. But again, I'm the foot doctor talking about brain surgery right now. So I would advise you to talk with an estate planning attorney.
Certainly sounds like a good idea, Gary. Good luck. Thank you for calling. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. George in Sturgeon Bay has a question that I think relates to something that off-air we were talking about earlier. So, George, it has to do with landlocked property. George, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I just heard part of this because I just got in the car and turned on the radio. But we have two 10-acre plots that are landlocked. We do, we're able to get an easement of, I think it's 30 some feet, but the county won't let us build under anything until we get an easement of, I don't even remember what it was. But we're basically, we can't use it other than walk on it. So I'm wondering if there's a way of being able to get that taken care of.
So it sounds like you need to, instead of 30 feet, you need more than 30 feet.
Yes, I think it's something like 60 feet. Their reasoning is if we were to build on it, they have to get fire back there and school buses and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and again, I think this one falls in a very large crack between what Tom and I know and what the rest of the world knows. But what I can tell you is that there are laws which protect you from being landlocked. And I, you know, and I would think, and I say think, because other than that one experience, this is not my field. But you know, my guess is that you certainly should talk to a lawyer, talk to somebody who specializes in land use and see what they have to say. Because effectively, if they're saying you can't build on it, then you are landlocked. I mean, it's at least for all useful purposes, or at least yours, you're not grazing goats, which was the case in my case years ago. You're not, you know, just having pets on the land. You're actually wanting to use it. So I think you need to talk to a land use attorney and see if you can get somebody. I mean, you probably have to go to whoever the zoning authority is, whether that's a village or a municipality or the county, and see what they will give you. And you might need, probably need to petition. If the law favors you, you might have to go to court. In my example, and that's not the sole example, I spent a lot of time dealing with smaller authorities. You don't have that problem so much with municipalities or the state or the county, but I suspect Tom's had the same experience. You can run into some significant degree of home cooking when you start dealing with smaller entities. That can be a problem. So who is it that's telling you that's telling you you have to have 60 feet? The county?
Okay. Oneida County Zone.
Okay. And have you asked the county if they'll give you an easement?
We've mentioned it a few times. This all came, I actually dealt with a trust of my father's.
Uh-huh.
And so this land in our family for a long, long time, as well as the mother's that's on a road, so we don't have to worry about that part. So, you know, as laws changed, all of a sudden this became under that whole situation.
Who gave you the easement for the 30 feet?
In the sense of...
was that the county or was it, a village or a municipality?
It was the county, and I basically just went to a surveyor, and he wrote up the papers for it. We thought we'd be under this sort of pre-law change. You know, if my dad had done something about it maybe 10 years ago before the fact,
the first thing I do is go back to the county and say, we need 60 feet. It's your rule. You're telling us we have to have 60 feet to build. Can we have 60 feet? Mm-hmm. And if they say no, then I think you need to get a lawyer.
Yeah. Yep. There you go, George. Good luck. Thank you for calling. And Jim in Evansville, we'll go to you. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I've got about $15,000 in credit card debt, very little assets, and I'm just wondering if I pass, does that credit card debt go away?
Tom?
I can jump in here, Jim. First of all, if you've got less than $50,000 in net value at the time of your passing, there's no obligation for your family to open up what's called a probate case. When a probate matter is opened up, the notice is sent to creditors, and they have a right to file a claim to be repaid in the event that your estate has sufficient assets after its expenses from which they could be paid. And then there's a process to dispute that and a process to challenge the priority. From the brief information that you shared, what I do want you to understand also is that whoever might inherit something from you or receive anything from you, if you're married or if you're unmarried and you have children, or if neither of those apply and you have siblings or parents still living, they're not obligated to pay those credit cards. And that's what most people end up asking is, can the credit card companies go after my family or my heirs or beneficiaries? And the answer to that is no, but kind of, if you have an estate that they can file a claim against. But in any event, what's really important for you to understand is if whoever would receive your property didn't sign the credit application form and the promise to pay on that contract with each creditor, with each credit card company, the credit card companies have no recourse against any of your family or friends or whoever you might want to leave some of your things to. So it doesn't sound very basically whether that's something that I think you should fret too much about. Unless your net estate value is above $50,000, and there's some crafty and strategic ways that we can maximize your risk of having to lose some of your estate to those debts.
All right.
Yeah. The only other thing I'd say is, you know, you might want to do two things. One, there's plenty of people out there advertising they can help you with your credit card debt. I'm not shilling for them because I have no idea. But it might be worth at least talking to someone saying, what can you actually do for me? Most often, you know, they want you to give them a bunch of money up front, which I'd be very leery about. The other thing is you could certainly talk to a bankruptcy lawyer, because I think Tom's spot on in terms of what happens if you die. But hopefully you're not going to die for a while. And dealing with these blood-sucking leeches would be fair, probably. No, I mean, look, the credit card companies give you money, but you know, they encourage these minimum payments, which drag people further and further in. And really, you should at least look at the possibility of bankruptcy, I think. And yeah, so you get this out and you can just start living your life and spending your own money, not having to make payments and seeing that amount grow and grow, which tends to happen.
Yeah. Jim, good luck. And thank you so much for calling. Mike Riley and Tom Kolpin are attorneys with the Axley Law Firm. Tom's situated in Janesville, Wisconsin, with the firm's a branch there, and Mike, of course, in Madison, and he's an of-counsel attorney for Axley. I'm Larry Mueller. You can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we talk legal issues with our two guests, Mike Riley and Tom Kolpin, at both practice law with the and members of the Axley Law Firm. It's great to have them with us today. And you can join in on open line, get you on pretty quickly. The number is 800-642-1234 and email to talk@wpr.org. We've got some emails. We'll get to those in just a minute, but I want to talk to Pat in DeForest first. Hi, Pat. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry.
What's on your mind?
I have a question about probate.
Okay.
My husband and I have a will, and we have three children, and all, you know, whatever's left of our estate when we pass would be divided equally among them. But I'm wondering, is that enough so that we don't have to go through probate if things are listed, or... I mean, do they have to be listed particularly in detail, or are we good?
Yeah, and maybe, Tom, you could, what is probate, or why would we need to go through probate to begin with?
Sure. Probate is the court process by which a will is administered. Like I mentioned to the last caller that dealt with some credit card questions, the probate process involves the need to notify the state of Wisconsin if there's been any Medicare that's been provided, and the ability to recoup from assets, payment of some of those provisions. There's also a duty to notify and provide deadlines for creditors to file claims. So if you've got a will and your estate, net value of your estate at the time of your passing is more than $50,000, then you will need to file a court action. Oftentimes it's called informal administration, a petition for informal administration. The main difference between informal administration and formal administration is that informal administration can happen largely outside of court with court-imposed deadlines and the filing of documents. formal administration requires you, whoever is going to be named your executor or your personal representative, to have a court hearing and receive court approval for every single action you do. Formal administration often happens when the families have conflict and the beneficiaries don't believe that the will should be administered in a certain way, so they file objections to the will and demands for formal proceedings. But informal administration sounds like something, unless your net estate value is under $50,000, that could be handled through what's called summary assignment or summary settlement, depending on the nature of what you have to pass down. But yes, from the example that you're explaining, it looks highly likely that probate would be something that your family would be involved in upon the passing of both of you and your husband. Upon the passing of one of you, assuming that your will says what most standard wills say in a marital property state, the property from one of you passes to the other, and there would not be a need to have a probate process for that.
Right.
Tom, you know, one thing that I think might be interesting to people is what happens if you don't have a will, if we call it being intestate.
Sure.
What's the difference between having a will and dying intestate?
Sure. You may run into the same need to handle things through a probate court. Again, if your net estate value at the time of your passing is more than $50,000. The key difference between having a will and not having one is that in the absence of a will, Wisconsin law identifies what we call intestate succession, which is who has priority to receive things upon your passing. Generally speaking, if you're married, your spouse receives your property upon your passing without a will. If you're married but don't have a will, or if you're unmarried but you have children and you don't have a will, your property passes to your children. If you're married and it's a second marriage and you have children from the first marriage and you die without a will, half of your property goes to your spouse and the other half goes to your children. So there's some unintended consequences, especially with blended families and second marriages, sometimes even third marriages, fifth marriages, where you really want to have a will to designate how you want things to pass if it's going to be significantly different than the laws of intestate succession.
And I suppose if you didn't have a wife or you didn't have never had a spouse and you've never had children, then siblings, I suppose, would come into play then.
Sure. I've always explained it to folks I talk to that in the absence of a will, intestate succession starts with your spouse. And if you don't have spouses, it goes to your children. If you don't have a spouse or a child or children, it goes up the family tree and then back out. So it goes all the way up to your parents. And if you don't have parents, it goes out to the next branch if you have siblings.
Yeah.
And then if you have none of those, then there's a process by which the state could receive your estate.
Pat, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Ryan in Cable, Wisconsin, it's your turn.
So I bought a house for my parents, but they bought the house for $104,900 and then spent $60,000 renovating it and then sold it to us for $74,000. Considering divorce at this point, how much would she be entitled to that house?
That's a very deeper question than simply what you've mentioned so far. You bought a house for $174,000. I think there's a lot of questions, which would be, when did you buy it? How long have you been married? What source of funds were used to purchase the house? How much in equity do you have in the house from the time you bought it to the time that you may be looking at a divorce? A variety of different factors come into play. The most notable of which is Wisconsin law is what we call a community property state, which means that in the absence of a prenuptial agreement or a postnuptial agreement, you might also hear that called a marital property reclassification agreement. In the absence of those, everything you bring to the marriage becomes marital property, and everything you have during your marriage, unless it's gifted or inherited, is also marital property. What you're telling me so far is, with very little facts to build from, that you bought a house during your marriage and that house will be marital property. The presumption is it's going to be divided equally. There's a variety of different factors under Wisconsin law called deviation considerations or deviation factors. Deviation simply means the court can consider to not dividing that asset equally or considering it a marital asset to be divided equally based upon factors such as the length of the marriage, contributions to the marriage, and a variety of other factors that might have unique significance to your situation. And there's some broad discretion from the courts within those factors to look at fairness and equity, because that's the primary purpose. A divorce and family court, it's a court of equity, despite what most people believe.
Tom, the one thing I thought, maybe I didn't hear correctly, but I thought he was saying that he bought the house for his parents, then they put money into it, raising the value significantly, and then they sold it back to them for a bargain.
So oh, I'm sorry. I didn't hear that.
I thought that was...
I think you're right.
So the...
Maybe explain again. Yeah. Give us that quick set
sorry,
of facts
Pat,
again.
Or I'm sorry, Ryan.
We're kind of running a little short here.
I apologize.
So they bought the house initially, and they invested at least $80,000 into it, and then they sold it back to me for a greatly reduced rate as part of my inheritance.
Okay.
Well, that's a little bit different than what I thought I heard the first time, and it's definitely a little closer than what Mike may have heard. Key here is what I heard the first time is the parents bought a house for $104,900. They put approximately $60,000 in it, and then they sold it to you, Ryan. And I'm presuming, based upon what you've told me so far, is that this was sold to you, purchased by you during your marriage. Now, if they sold you a home at far less than fair market value and said, we are giving you this reduced price because you're now going to have a home cheaper than what we could sell it to anyone else for, so this equity that you receive is part of our quote-unquote inheritance to you, or what I'll call an advance on inheritance, then I would hope for your sake that they have some very clear documentation indicating that that was technically a gift directly to you only. But in the absence of a marital property agreement, classifying a certain part of that home as your separate and non-marital property, that's going to be a hairy situation for you.
Yeah. There you go, Ryan. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dave emailed me. I don't know if we can do this in 30 seconds or so or 40 seconds, but Dave emailed to ask revocable versus an irrevocable trust. What's an advantage? Is one more advantageous than the other?
Sure. I'll try to do that quick. Revocable and irrevocable are exactly how they sound. If you have a revocable trust, that means that if anything ever happens in your lifetime, that you decide, I don't want this anymore, perhaps a family creates the Bill and Sue revocable family trust, and then Bill and Sue get divorced. They terminate that trust. It's revocable. You can close it out. You can reassign all the assets in a divorce case to who might receive them. That's one example. Family changes. That's an example. An irrevocable trust, once you create it, you can't revoke it. And many people do that to divest from themselves property they own in advance of applying for Medicare in the future. And they have a 5-year look back to see if you've transferred any assets out of your own name. And they consider you not the owner of the property if it's an irrevocable trust.
And on that note, we're going to take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll be back with Mike Riley and Tom Kolpian from the Axley Law Firm of Madison, Janesville, and elsewhere. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us here on WPR News. We are talking with Mike Riley and Tom Culpine from the Axley Law Firm. Tom works out of Janesville. Mike is in Madison, located at their Madison office. Taking your questions, and you can join in, 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Listener email that you mentioned property owners should make sure they have good insurance. How do you find a good company?
Well, first thing, I mean, we do have an insurance commissioner's office that takes complaints. They've got a list of the companies and the number of complaints they get. Not a sure thing, but it's certainly something that's worth looking at. I'm sure you can find that online. You know, we have a number of good companies in Wisconsin. I tend to lean in that direction. American Family here in Madison, Rural Mutuals here in Madison. There are a number of other companies. West Bend is, a company in West Bend. And those are all Wisconsin companies. And I've dealt with all those companies over the years. And I'm generally on the other side, although I worked for insurance companies early in my career, but I represent people who are injured, and so I have to deal with them. And I think those companies are a cut above a lot of the other companies I deal with. So I think that's one thing to think about. I think there are some national companies. USAA is a company that represents, you have to have had some connection with the military.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's pretty attenuated now what that takes. And I've always found them to be a good company. Amica is another company that I've dealt with over the years. And there are a lot of others when I don't mean to just single, but people ask the question. And I think that's at least a fair starting point.
Good answer there. John in Eau Claire, we'll give you a chance to join in. John, hello.
Hello. I had a little question about estate planning. We had a situation in my family where my aunts got remarried later on in life. They each had children from prior marriages. And once her husband passed away, her second husband, 100% of their assets went to my aunt and her children. His children didn't get anything. So my question is, how can I avoid that situation? I'm significantly older than my wife. We have significant assets. And, if I should pass away first and my wife gets remarried and then passed, how can I ensure that our assets go to our children, not to her future husband's children?
Yeah. Okay, Tom?
Yeah, sure. John, this is something that I think happens more frequently than people understand. This day and age with blended families, I happen to be someone who has a blended family, so I can certainly relate to this question. If you don't create advanced planning directives that strictly control how and when and under what circumstances your children from a prior marriage are to receive your property, in the event that you pass away first, it won't happen, other than simply the trust of your partner ensuring that that person won't change their will in the future. So oftentimes you see a husband and wife of second marriages, they go get estate plans together and they say, if I pass away, all of my property goes to my spouse, and their reciprocal wills, we'll call them, they're mirrored. And then something happens where one of you pass away early, your spouse is widowed, maybe they even remarry. And you can see that trickle down effect, very similar to how your aunt's situation occurred. If you don't strictly allocate those assets in a way that is non-revocable, you always run the risk that something like that can happen. So you're going to want to meet with an estate planning attorney. Oftentimes, this can be done in a trust or even during your lifetime, transferring ownership of certain assets or payable on death for certain bank accounts, or what we call also termination on death, TOD or POD accounts, where you can say, I'm leaving these things to my children, maybe in the form of life insurance, or if you've got a retirement account that can just pass on death automatically, where it's not something that can be controlled by your current spouse and then in the future changed by your widow. There's some strategic ways that you can do that, and it really depends on your unique financial circumstances, what assets you have, and how you can reallocate them.
So he should be talking to an attorney who specializes?
Yeah, I would definitely.
Estate planning.
Absolutely. I would recommend that.
You need to have that. He actually needs to have that if he wants.
If that's what his goal is and he wants to minimize that risk, I have never once jumped into the cockpit of a 747 mm-hmm. and asked if I could fly the plane. So.
Yeah, all right. There you go. Thank you so much for calling, John. Mark in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Mark.
Oh, yes, I was doing some genealogical research at the Historical Society, and I found a probate from 1901 about would be a great aunt, but half. Her mother and my great-grandfather's mother were the same. So they somehow uncovered two relatives, one living in Budapest and one living in Aachen, Germany. And they sent letters to those U.S. consulates in those two places and went to those addresses and asked a bunch of questions whether those two folks would have any claim to the estate of my great aunt. How did they do that?
Oh boy, Mark, this is like a law school question. Like on the,
and God, we feared those.
Yeah, I wouldn't even know where to start with something like this. I think you need to talk and sit down with a lawyer. There's probably layers to this. This looks like a big onion. I wouldn't even know where to start. I apologize.
Oh, yeah,
and if Tom can't be helpful, I'm far removed from being helpful. So.
There you go, Mark. You're going to have to dig into this with somebody who's going to sit down and really take a lot of time probably to figure out how they figured out where those people were.
Well, I guess I'm not even clear if Mark's asking, is he entitled to get something or is he just interested?
How do they look deeper into who else could be receive things from the state? This sounds like an Indiana Jones type story.
Yeah. Man, oh, man. Jan in Madison, we're on to you now. Hi, Jan.
Hi there. I have something for Paul in Puma.
Okay.
I have some alternative suggestions for him.
Oh, good.
In Eau Claire, this is in several communities of size. In Eau Claire, we have something called the Eau Claire Community Foundation. And they help people set up the very thing that Paul is thinking of doing. Hmm. And they work a lot with your local community organizations that you probably would be interested in. The second thing is, besides the Community Foundation, is working through one of our Wisconsin colleges or universities to set up either a partial or a full scholarship. And the information you can get would be go right to the University Foundation for that information. So just two alternatives.
All right, Jan, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. I set up a little scholarship fund myself for the UW-Madison, my home academic department. So, yeah.
That's great.
Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. We have some more emails here before we go back to the phones. And you can join in. There's lines open at 800-642-1234. You can email to talk at WPR.org. David Madison emailed, he needs to write a simple will other than the considerable cost. What are the advantages of hiring an attorney versus using an internet service? He says a simple will, but I don't know what that means.
Sure. A simple will, I have to assume, is just basically going to name who you want to be your personal representative. If there's anything you have as far as personal belongings that you want someone individually to receive, your Brett Favre football collection or baseball cards or something like that. But, you know, generally speaking, I think if it's simple enough, you can draft it even on your own as long as you have it properly witnessed. These internet-based companies oftentimes will sell you state-specific forms. I'm aware of people that used to go back in the day to Office Max and pick up a form template for a will and fill them out that way. The only thing I would say is that if you don't know what Wisconsin law's requirements are for conformities of a will, you won't know whether that internet company has the right form, and you won't know whether, if you draft it yourself, will be proper. That being said, to the general public, if you don't have sophisticated situations, Wisconsin law is set up to try to take into account and make effective your intentions as much as possible in the absence of, like, extraordinarily procedural defects in your will. So there's presumptions that we want to follow your intent. And I guess that's the best I can tell you.
Yeah.
I just, for the peace of mind, I would encourage you to call and shop around, because there's a lot of flat fees that can be handled for a simple will. And in the absence of high conflict that could be created after your passing, where people are spending, it becomes extremely emotionally or financially expensive for your family to fight about something that wasn't drafted appropriately, the minimal cost of the upfront flat fee seems to be reasonable.
You know, if a lawyer drafts a will and screws it up, lawyers have insurance, they have malpractice coverage, you can do something about it. If one of these companies sells you one of these things and it doesn't work, I doubt you're going to have any recourse at all.
That's a great point.
Yeah. The University of Wisconsin Extension, through Family Resources and Consumer Sciences, I believe, came up with several materials, printed materials on wills, and I think even one was on doing your own will, and that was sort of Wisconsin-based. So that might be just for your own information. It'd be worth looking, going online to UW Extension, type in wills, and that Wisconsin-based information could at least be helpful to you as well.
Yeah, spent a lot of time talking about wills, and people have asked questions. And the truth is, you know, if you draft something and you draft it specifically, somebody asked about, well, I don't want these people to have anything. Well, you just say that. I mean, it's not enough to say who you want to have something. If you have somebody you don't want to have something, you know, rather than having them challenge it. And as Tom said, anybody can challenge anything. But it's really not going anywhere if you have said specifically. And the courts, as Tom said, are going to try to enforce your intent. But I think that's a great idea, Larry. Look at that. If you're going to try to do it yourself, make sure you have the appropriate information to do that.
Yeah. Stella in Sturgeon Bay, we'll go to you now.
Hi. I have a question, and then I also have a comment. The question is, my husband and I don't have children, and we have all of our liquid assets set up to be the survivor inherits, the survivor takes ownership, and then the ultimate, I guess it's payable on death, I'm not sure, but the ultimate, when the survivor dies, the assets pass directly to a charitable organization that we support. All of our liquid type assets, bank accounts and so on, are set up that way. We have three parcels of real estate, the house that we live in, which we hope to be carried out of in a box, and two parcels of recreational property that we are in the process of selling, but that is proceeding very slowly. So my question is, with the real estate, can we set it up the same way that the survivor of the two of us takes ownership upon the death of the first, and then when the survivor dies, can the real estate property, if it hasn't sold yet, can it pass directly to the charity and not have to go through probate?
Thanks, Stella. With respect to the real estate, you can certainly draft. Right now, your deeds to those pieces of real estate probably say joint tenants with the right of survivorship, or they're titled that way. And then you can create termination on death deeds, they're called, where you can name the agency or organization that you would want to receive or become the rightful owner of that land upon your passing. I've always careful that I would want to see the document myself as an attorney to make sure that it's drafted the right way. So you shouldn't just presume that what I'm saying right now you can just go quickly do without any legal review. But yes, the quick answer is there's a process for that. The other thing I would encourage you to do, to the extent that it doesn't create more family conflict for you, is make your intentions widely known. That's where you want your property to go. that you don't want it passing to a particular family. This is your choice. And then when you do those termination on death deeds, you're presumed competent, that you have the right to make the decisions yourself with your property during your lifetime. My advice to you is that if you go do that, have obviously you're going to have a witness or someone notarize your signature on the deed, but have some extra documentation or ask someone to at least create a memo that they met with you, that they talked to you about this. This is certainly your intention. Because oftentimes with family, when they feel like they've been written out of something, they want to argue and say someone's been negatively influenced and they were susceptible to that influence because of their age, infirmities, or anything like that. So your competence at the time that you signed these types of directives is something that you want to make sure you have some extra evidence of.
Yeah. I had knew someone who left his home, half of the home to his daughter and the other half to his church. Mm-hmm. And he talked to both the daughter and got her to, you know, sort of buy, told her what he was going to do, got the buy-in, talked to the church. And it, I guess, went off without a hitch when,
sure,
when that happened.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point by both of you. So often we don't do that, and that's what we need to do. Communication is so critical, and it's so easy, but you have to do it. And as Tom says, it's also important to memorialize it in some cases just to make sure there's no question.
Yeah. Stella, thank you. Judy and Delavan, your turn.
Thank you. I'm administering my brother's estate. One of the heirs lives in California. He is dependent on SSI and whatever help California gives him, and he is refusing his inheritance for fear that he will wind up homeless, and because when he gets any money, they cut back on his support. My lawyer is trying to set up a needs trust, but my nephew tells me, leave me alone, I don't want anything to do with the lawyers. I don't know what to do now.
The first thing I would encourage you to do is make sure that you have all cards on the table with your lawyer. Make sure that your lawyer has all the same information that you have to properly advise you, and rely upon the advice of that lawyer. Your nephew has a right to say, I don't want anything. For any reason, whether it's something that we agree with or disagree with. And usually that term is called disclaimer, where you can say, I don't want it. And maybe the will or the estate planning documents provide for the next step down for what happens to that. But I'm highly confident that unless your lawyer started doing probate for the first time ever in your case, that there's going to be an exact protocol to do that. The needs trust that you mentioned, I don't know if it's a special needs trust. Those are quite intricate to create, but once you create them, they're protected forever for the benefit of the person with special needs. It doesn't sound like your nephew might have the basis for a special needs, but perhaps he does. But even in that event, no one's obligated to provide him things if he doesn't want them.
Yeah, the one thing, and I think Tom would say the same thing, you ought to get a written disclaimer from the nephew.
Yeah.
You need something from him. Your lawyer should certainly be able to draft something and just have him sign off on it and say, I don't want anything. Even a special needs trust, and I'm familiar with the term but don't know a lot about him, but it sounds like his concern is if he gets even constructive possession of this money, they're going to cut him off out there potentially, and he's probably much better off with what he's getting out there. But it's his decision to make, and he's made it. He just needs to document it.
And then Judy will have choices or things to make in terms of what to do with that money.
Well, I'd assume if, you know, barring something, unless it says specifically in the will, I'd assume that whoever else inherits, you just split that among them, wouldn't you, Tom?
You know, the other thing, my brain's going in a couple different circles now and thinking about the nephew. And I don't want to jump to the presumption that because he's receiving any kind of government assistance and he doesn't want to jeopardize that, that somehow he might have some other bigger issues going on. But when you brought up the portion of a needs trust, it makes me wonder whether or not the nephew should have appointed an attorney for him in Wisconsin called a guardian ad litem, which is an attorney that represents the best interests of people who may not be able to advocate properly for themselves. The court would appoint that attorney, and it could potentially be an expense from the estate, or the county might even front that cost, depending upon the nature of your estate. But someone should be looking out for your nephew's best interests, even if he can't. And that might be another wrinkle. I would advise you to talk to your attorney and see if that's an option.
So it does sound like Judy's trying to work in his best interest. But
yeah, absolutely.
For sure. Good luck, Judy. Thank you for calling. John and Marinette emailed, this is probably our last question, that he and his wife held several stocks jointly. She died in December. Does his basis in any sum or all of the shares change? Oh, that may be something you guys may not be able to answer.
Yeah. Outside my field, certainly.
Yeah. Martha emailed, they moved to Wisconsin from another state within the past year. Their will and health care directive were established within the past 3 years in the state of Georgia. Will the will still be valid in Wisconsin, and what legally needs to be done for an address change? They no longer own property in Georgia, but now have property in Wisconsin.
Sure. I will never profess to know anything about Georgia law except for my father being a Georgia Bulldogs fan, and everything is Bulldogs in his life. But my best advice to you would be to recreate a new will in Wisconsin that conforms with Wisconsin law if your intention is to reside and be what we call domiciled in the state of Wisconsin by the time you pass. Maybe this isn't your landing spot, but it could be for unforeseeable reasons too. I believe that portions of your Georgia will, or maybe all of it, could be enforceable in Wisconsin. To the extent that Georgia has different kinds of laws that could affect succession of assets, I would hate for you to have your entire plan only be partially accepted. And that seems to be a silly approach to it in the event that you can create a new will and have a lawyer compare the two laws, look at what you want, and see whether or not it needs to be completely redrafted. Changing your address was sort of an ancillary question there. Changing your address can be with any governmental agency, third party company, and you do that no matter what. If you're living and you're domiciled in the state of Wisconsin at the time of your passing, whatever estate planning directives you have, that's what will be used, because you can't write a new one after you've passed away. So,
and on that note, Mike, Tom, thank you both very much for being with us. I hope we can this again down the road. We didn't get to everything for sure, but hopefully we can do it another time.
Thanks, Larry.
Thank you.
Michael Riley, counsel attorney, and of counsel attorney at Axley Law Firm, Tom Copleen, is an attorney who practices family law, paternity, estate planning, and more. His partner, they're both in Axley Law Firm. Tom's in Janesville with the firm's office there, and Mike's in Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Mueller here. Thanks for staying with us on WPR News. We're talking about how to make better coffee right at home, and we have a guest who knows all about that. Ryan Castellas is with us. Ryan's the founder and CEO of Discourse Coffee in Milwaukee. He's the author of The New Art of Coffee, From Morning Cup to Caffeine Cocktail. As we talk with him, I hope you'll join in with your own questions. Tell us how you make your coffee. What's your favorite creamer? Do you make your own syrup? Do you prefer it hot or cold? Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Ryan, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining in.
Larry, such a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, listen, your website, Discourse Coffee, I really like it. What your website says, you're a coffee workshop. What does that mean?
Yes, sir.
What does that mean?
You know, it's a long story, Larry. So we started 8 years ago up in Door County, Wisconsin, in Sister Bay, a beautiful little idyllic town up there. And something that we were always really serious about when we started was this ability to be constantly creating and innovating and changing. And at the time, and still very much now, you know, the coffee industry was very much ruled by kind of rote routine. This is what we do every day. We serve the same people every day. And we wanted something that was dynamic and new and fun and kind of a constant work in progress. And so instead of calling it a coffee shop, we decided at that time to call it a liquid workshop, something that was constantly in motion, something that was constantly changing. And upon moving to the city of Milwaukee in 2021, we thought it was necessary to disclaim to people that indeed we do serve coffee as our primary beverage. And so we changed to coffee workshop, but still keeping that workshop mentality of this is a dynamic experience. It's an evolving experience. And it's something that is a little bit different every time we come to enjoy it.
So what do you love about coffee and making new drinks?
Oh, man, what do I not love about coffee? I think what I love most about coffee is its diversity and its ingenuity and its constant evolution. You know, coffee is an agricultural product stemming back thousands of years. It is the most aromatically complex thing on planet Earth, far more complex than wine, and is the most widely consumed drug on the planet. About 1 billion cups of coffee a day are consumed. And yet it is still something that is so young in terms of its understanding. And what I mean by that is, Larry, if I were to say, I would like some juice, you would probably ask me some qualifying questions, right? Like, oh, do you prefer orange juice or apple juice? Do you want pulp or no pulp? Right? And these are things that we've acclimated to in our society. But if you were to say, if I were to say, hey, Larry, I'd like some coffee, you'd probably just pour me a cup of coffee. You wouldn't ask, oh, do you prefer Ethiopia or Panama or Colombia or Guatemala? Do you like a natural or a washed? Do you like a funkier cup? Do you want it immersion or pour over, right? But coffee is so diverse. It has all of this range. And so I love within coffee that we have infinite history, you know, history stretching back thousands of years, and yet our understanding of its potential is still so young. And so we get to play simultaneously in this space of legacy and inspiration and novelty. And that to me is just an endless joy. It truly is something that is kind of timeless and at the same time ever evolving.
Well, let's talk about brewing better coffee at home. Coffee starts, of course, with beans. What are some things to think about when you go to the store to buy beans?
Yeah, so a couple of big things, right? The first is, if you live in the proximity of a roastery, a local roaster, go directly to source, right? Go to the roastery, go to a coffee shop that you trust that sells retail coffee, and talk to the baristas, talk to the team, talk to the roaster, the manager, and let them know what you like in coffee, right? And they are probably going to be able to point you to one of their products that best suits your needs and desires. They surely have a lot more information for you than the local grocery store, and almost definitely are going to be able to provide coffee for you that's been roasted more recently, is fresher and a more vibrant expression of the product. So my number one recommendation is always go, if you have one, go to a local roastery or a local coffee shop. And we're so lucky in 2025 that I'd say the overwhelming majority of American communities have at least one coffee shop that is conscientious about the sourcing and the maintenance of their coffee. If that is not an option for you and you are going to the grocery store, my biggest recommendation, you know, is to understand the notes that you are looking for in coffee and do a little bit of research ahead of time to discover, okay, what coffee is going to best suit these desires. So if I want a really chocolatey, rich, you know, bittersweet, 90% dark chocolate, a little bit of caramel, but like really rich and bitter and intense and kind of has that potent characteristic to it that sometimes is really enjoyable in coffee. I might be looking for a Northern Italian roast, right, where they're going to roast it really dark. I want a really dark roast because what I want to taste is the charred oils on the outside of those beans. If I decide that I want something a little more caramely, a little more nutty, but I might go to something from South or Central America, something like Brazil or El Salvador. And if I want something that's fruitier, I might look at a Colombian coffee or an Ethiopian coffee or a Panamanian coffee, coffees that grow in warmer climates where that sugar concentrates and you get this beautiful kind of fruitiness or tropicality or berry character that can come out in the coffee. So recommendation number one, try to hit a local roastery. Recommendation number two, if you can't, inform yourself a little bit about what you're looking for before you go into the grocery store. So when you're there, you can look for exactly the coffee that fits your desires.
That makes a lot of sense. I'm wondering, you know, I've interviewed folks recently about chocolate and ethically sourced cacao. What does it mean for coffee to be ethically sourced?
It's a terrific question and a super, super important one. You know, so over the last 10, really 20 years now, in the advent of what we call third wave coffee, or the movement of coffee that came after the second wave shops like Starbucks and Caribou, that's really focused on quality and really focused on transparency, the equity model for coffee has completely transformed. And, you know, something I think that's really important to remember, Larry, about both coffee and chocolate, is that coffee is an agricultural product, right? So when we see this roasted little bean, but it starts off as the seed of a cherry on a farm in a distant land, right? And so in creating a system of equity within coffee, the real answer, the real question, right, is how do we get the most amount of capital and equity into the farmers' hands, the people who are empowering the entirety of the process. And, you know, for a while, fair trade was kind of the thing, and then organic kind of swooped in. And organic coffee is really not as equitable as many people may think it is, because organic certification is very expensive. And many farmers around the world simply cannot afford the pay to play to create organic certification, even if their processes are at or above the level of certification for an organic farm. So the true nature of an equitable relationship in coffee today is what we call the direct trade partnership. And what that means is that the farmer and the buyer, the roaster, have a direct relationship. The roaster has been out to the farm, they've tasted the lots, they've met the farmer. And oftentimes now, a roastery will actually buy an entire lot. So they'll come to a farm, they'll taste many different lots on what's called a cupping table, or essentially a tasting table for coffees. And when they identify the ones that they like, they will purchase the entire lot of that coffee. And this has really been a sea change from 20 years ago, where many, 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 many small shareholder farms would all send their coffees to central mills, where the coffees would be blended and processed and then sold as a coffee that represented that mill, right? And that mill then set the prices for all of the farmers. Now, American, Japanese, Korean buyers are working directly with farmers, advocating for the most equitable price for the farmer. And so the most equitable way that you can invest in coffee today is through direct trade relationships, which are held by many of today's most kind of modern and successful roasteries.
So how do you know then that you're buying some coffee that has been ethically sourced, the beans?
You know, I think the absolute best way, alluding to my first point, is head into a roastery, you know, and look at that roastery's website. If a roastery is doing direct trade, they will be loud about it. You know, they'll be earnest and honest about their transparency. And we actually, in the industry now, we call this a transparency report. And many roasteries that are really pursuing coffee at high levels provide immense amounts of information in their transparency reports about who they bought the coffee from, the lot, the farmer, the processor, the mill. Every step of the journey is clarified for the consumer. Sage does an amazing job of this out in Brooklyn, and they sell nationally. Onyx does an amazing job of this in Arkansas, and they sell nationally. So these are some really, really cool brands that you can trust are doing equitable work. But stopping into your local roastery and just saying, hey, do you have any coffees that were sourced on direct trade or fair trade arrangements is going to be your number one best bet. If that is not available to you, oftentimes at the grocery store, they will label fair trade. And if you flip the bag around and read the little story on the back, you can oftentimes get a sense of, does this roastery have a direct relationship with this farmer? You know, sometimes the bag will say something like, we've worked with this farmer for three seasons now. You know, and in those cases, you know that these are roasteries that prioritize building long-standing equitable relationships between the producers of the agricultural and the roasters of the consumer good.
Ryan Castales, our guest today, founder and CEO of Discourse Coffee, talking with him about coffee and, you know, making a good cup of it. And we'll get into some more detail on that as we move along today. He's the author of the book, The New Art of Coffee, From Morning Cup to Caffeine Cocktail. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Well, I have a cup of coffee pretty much every morning, or maybe I'll have a couple of cups of coffee. What about you? It's fun talking about a good cup of coffee with our guest today, Ryan Castales. Ryan is the founder and CEO of Discourse Coffee and author of The New Art of Coffee, From Morning Cup to Caffeine Cocktail. You can call in with your own questions. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. Just a look ahead. Tomorrow on the show, a couple of things that I think you're going to find interesting. We're going to be talking about the treatments for movement disorders. That's one of our topics. We'll be talking with the doctors about that. And we're going to also cover all you need to know about choosing an assisted living center for yourself or for a loved one. And I've had to go through that process myself. And so I'll have some comments of my own as we talk about assisted living center work on the show tomorrow. But right now, Ryan Castales is our guest. And you can join in again. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Ryan, should you grind your own beans, or can you buy pre-ground coffee?
You should absolutely grind your own beans. If there's one thing that you can do to increase the quality of your coffee at home, once you've bought the right beans for you, is to grind fresh at the time of brewing. So coffee is super, super, super subject to oxidation, which means that oxygen is hitting a thing and it's denaturing the beauty of it. Right? You're losing a lot of the volatile aromatics that make coffee so wonderful. And as soon as you grind it, you greatly increase that volatilization of all of those beautiful aromatics that we want to capture in the cup. So having a home grinder is absolutely a great way to increase the quality of your coffee. If you must buy pre-ground, toss it in the freezer. That's going to slow down that oxidation just a little bit.
And the grinders themselves, I mean, are there good ones and bad ones? Or
yes.
Oh, there are.
And we could have a whole conversation, like a literally probably 6-hour radio show just about the differences between grinders. But, you know, at a home consumer level, you know, you're going to get a better quality burr set, which is the two moving discs that create the ground coffee, with a manual grinder for a lower price than you will for an electric grinder. So if you don't mind doing a little manual labor in the morning to wake up, it is, you will almost always get a higher quality grind out of a hand grinder at the same price as an electric grinder. In the electric grinder world, there's so many different price points that you could buy into, from $100 up to $5,000. Oh. And, you know, I think at the $100 to $200 price range, looking at a grinder from either Fellow, they have a wonderful grinder called the Ode that does an excellent job for around $169, $200. Or looking at some of the early Baratza models, like the Baratza Preciso, are a great entry-level model that you can get into for a pretty affordable price that will radically transform the quality of your coffee at home.
Hmm. Nate in Middleton has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Nate.
Hey, good afternoon. Ryan, tell me, for a person who's making a single cup of coffee per day, AeroPress, pour over, what's the best option, full flavor?
Man, that's a great, great question. On a single cup, I think you probably nailed it on that AeroPress, but it's really going to depend on what you're looking for in terms of body. So if you are cool with a little bit lighter body, a little bit more clarity in the cup, if you prefer coffees from like Africa, Panama, Colombia, high altitude, you might be better served with a pour over like the Wave or the Switch from Hario. I love the Switch because you can either choose, do you want immersion, do you want a little more body today, or do you want that clarity of a more high bypass brew method? The Switch from Hario would be awesome for you. But if you want a big, chewy body, I think the AeroPress is definitely the way to go. If you want that clarity, I would look into something like the Switch or the Wave.
Oh, Nate, there you go. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Rick in McFarland. Rick, hello. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call, Larry. Say, I wanted to say that when guests visit our house, they always seem to remember that we offer heavy cream when we serve our coffee. And also, when we go out and buy coffee elsewhere, it rarely comes with cream. It's usually with a half and half. And I just want to know what your guest thinks of that.
Right.
I love the fact that you use heavy cream at home. You know, the economics of half and half make a lot more sense for most cafes. And also many cafes stock half and half to be able to produce breves, you know, which is a latte made with half and half instead of whole milk or alternative milk. So half and half, I think, will continue to kind of be that cafe staple. But most cafes are going to have some heavy whipping cream lying around. So if you have a strong preference for heavy whip, feel free to ask your barista. There's a pretty good chance that they might have it while out.
Ah, Rick, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. We got an email back to the question of grinders. Which are the easiest to clean, and how often should you be cleaning your machine?
That's a great question. You know, I've always found hand grinders to be the easiest to clean. Something like a Porlax JP40 is a great little low budget, easy to travel with hand grinder that can be very, very easily cleaned because it's very easy to disassemble it. You know, full cleaning regimens on a grinder can be kind of intimidating. You're opening up a mechanical thing. You're separating two birds. You have to make sure that you maintain alignment to ensure quality. And so it can be a little intimidating. But an easy weekly clean is purchasing some grinds. It's a product from Urnex, U-R-N-E-X. And the product is just called Grinds with a Z. And work about 30 to 40 grams of grinds through your grinder once a week, and you should be in a really good spot with maintaining that clarity and the cleanliness of the inside of your machine.
Nina in Menasha has a question. Let's go there. Hi.
Good afternoon. Oh, my gosh. You are so knowledgeable, and, the passion is wonderful to hear. Thank you. I'm going to look up your website when I'm done off this call. My question is, I was raised roasting beans and stuff. My grandparents, they're past, their business is gone. But I personally order green beans from a Wisconsin company, and I roast them at home myself. But I never know about the processing method. Like, there's natural, washed, semi-washed, and I really get confused. What would you recommend? I mean, is there a better I try to do organic, but you never know. You just got to trust them.
Washed.
100%.
Yeah, washed or semi-washed beans or what have you. What about it? Ryan?
Yeah, so first off, Nina, thank you so much. And it's so wonderful to hear when people are roasting at home. I love a little home roaster. There isn't one that is unanimously better. Myself, I have a preference for naturals. But I want to give you a really quick walkthrough that's just going to hopefully demystify what the heck they mean when they're talking about these things. So a washed coffee is a coffee where the producer is going to wash off the mucilage or the cherry that surrounds the seed of the coffee. And that seed is actually coffee. That's what we enjoy. And so in a washed coffee, all of that mucilage is washed off in a turbid water bath. And what that does is it creates a much lighter, cleaner cup of coffee. It's going to be a little less juicy or jammy, but it's going to really highlight floral, citrusy flavors. A natural coffee, they call it such as it was the original processing method for coffee, is where they just remove the outer layer of the cherry, and they keep all of that mucilage, all of that fruit, to dry into the coffee on the drying bed. And what that does is it creates a much richer, more dynamic, more fruity, more jammy cup of coffee. And I love those coffees, but a lot of coffee purists really prefer washed coffees. Now, in the middle of those two worlds, in what you're referring to as semi-washed, is what we call honeyed coffees. And honey coffees are a hybrid. They remove a varying degree of mucilage from the coffee. And you'll see terms like red honey, black honey, white honey. And these refer to the amount of mucilage that's left on the bean. So honeys are your hybrid coffees. They're right in between the clarity of a washed cup and the dynamic, juicy vibrancy of a natural cup. So there really isn't a better and a worse. I have excellent coffee professionals in our ranks who prefer washed, and I have excellent professionals who prefer naturals. It really is a matter of preference, but know that washed is going to give you a cleaner, more delicate cup, and natural is going to give you a more jammy, more robust cup.
Nina, thank you so much for calling. There have been really beautiful espresso machines all over the internet, anywhere from hundreds to thousands of dollars. What's an entry-level way to make espresso at home?
It was actually hinted at by the first caller here. Probably the most affordable way to make an espresso-ish coffee at home is going to be an Aeropresso. And I actually have a recipe for Aeropresso in my book. Aeropresso is essentially a concentrated coffee using an Aeropress. And espresso, there's a common misunderstanding that espresso is a type of coffee. It is not. Espresso is a brew method, and it is created by the inclusion of pressure in the brewing environment. So what's beautiful about an Aeropress is that you are the pressure. You push down on that plunger and you create a pressurized environment that enables you to grind quite fine and create crema, which is the emulsified oils of coffee that really only reveal themselves when put under pressure at a fine grind. So an Aeropress, which can be purchased for about $40, $50 online, and then using the Aeropresso method is going to be the cheapest way to get into a home espresso. Beyond that, you could get a lever machine, and they sell cheap levers now through companies like Flair for $300 to $500. Or you can upgrade to one of the beautiful Breville units, like the Oracle, that runs around
$1,200. Oh, lots of money there. I'm telling you, I looked at your website, Discourse Coffee, and I thought, I've got to get over and try out some of your drinks.
We would love that, Larry.
Give me one that you like a lot and what's in it.
Absolutely.
Go ahead. We got about a minute.
Perfect. They're all kind of my babies, so it's like picking a favorite kid. But I'd say the most universally popular right now is our Channel Orange. And our Channel Orange is a take on a vanilla latte. So we start with a base of espresso, and then we take vanilla syrup. We oak age it on oak chips using an ultrasonic bath, and then we infuse it with a little bit of oak smoke. From there, we make a syrup from orange peels called oleosacrum, and blend the two. To create a little bit of bitterness, because our espresso is sweet, not bitter, we use blackjack bitters from Bittercube, which bring a flavor of molasses. And then on top of the milk, after we pour the latte, we add a little bit of candied orange powder from the peels of that orange oleosacrum and some black lava salt. And almost all of our coffees are salted. Salt and coffee just creates really beautiful, dynamic, accentuated flavors and balances out any bitterness.
Oh, boy. Ryan, this has been a pleasure. We're out of time. Thank you so much. Will you be with us again? Come back and be with us sometime?
Anytime. I would absolutely love that. Thank you so much for having me.
Ryan Castellas, the founder and CEO of Discourse Coffee. You can find that online. He's also the author of The New Art of Coffee, From Morning Cup to Caffeine Cocktail. I'm Larry Mueller, and again, thank you for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.